You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see a full room. Welcome to Brookings. We're going to have an interesting conversation over the next 2 hours. My name is Tamar Manuel-Yanatunch. I'm a visiting fellow at Brookings. In fact, a very new one. I started at the beginning of this month, so it is my pleasure to be here to moderate this conversation today. The topic, I am sure you have received the information, and I hope you have also managed to get yourselves hard copies of the report that's being launched. The topic is on a governance index that the Revenue Watch Institute is launching that is looking at the oil, gas, and minerals sector in countries that produce those resources. Danny Kaufman, who is the president of the Revenue Watch Institute, will start us off with a presentation. I expect he'll take about 15 to 20 minutes. Then we have two eminent discussants, Carlos Pascual, who's the special envoy and coordinator for international energy affairs in the U.S. government, and then George Ingram, who's a senior fellow at the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. They will be discussing for about 7 to 10 minutes and providing commentary on the presentation that Danny Kaufman will be making, as well as the report that's being launched today. I'm not going to take a great deal of time to talk about the importance of the topic, because I am sure Danny will be doing that. But we do know that there are a large number of natural resource wealthy countries that have had issues in terms of converting that natural resource wealth into good development outcomes. And the premise, I think, of this index is on accountability and governance, is that by publishing this information, putting this information out into the public domain, that multiple stakeholders will be able to use this information and improve the way governments manage these crucial resources and improve the well-being of their population. So let me quickly introduce each of the speakers, and then I will ask Danny Kaufman to come up to the podium to provide the presentation. Once he's done the presentation and we've heard from the discussants, what I propose to do is ask about three questions myself, and then open it up for your comments and questions, and we'll have, I hope, a lively discussion that it will be my pleasure to moderate. So on to our scholars. Danny Kaufman, as I mentioned, he is at the moment the president of the Revenue Watch Institute. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings at the Global Economy and Development Program. And he has been a longtime colleague of mine from the World Bank, so it is my pleasure to welcome him back to Brookings. I think many of you who are interested in governance will know that Danny is a well-published, well-cited, and sought-after speaker and scholar in this domain. He carries out policy analysis and applied research on economic development, governance, regulation, and corruption around the world. At the World Bank, he has held many senior positions, and his last position was as director at the World Bank Institute, where he pioneered new approaches to measure and analyze governance and corruption, helping countries formulate action programs. Danny is a member of the Global Agenda Council at the World Economic Forum, a member of the board of the Revenue Watch Institute, as well as a member of the advisory boards of Transparency International and the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. He's a Chilean national who received his PhD in economics at Harvard, and he blogs and tweets, and I guess that's a reminder for me to let you know that this session is also being web streamed. Our first discussant is Carlos Pascual. Ambassador Pascual is the State Department Special Envoy and Coordinator for International Energy Affairs. He was appointed by Secretary Clinton as ambassador to this position. Almost, it looks like it's an anniversary coming up, 2 years ago in May 2011. In this capacity, he advises the Secretary on energy issues, ensuring that energy security is advanced at all levels of U.S. foreign policy. Prior to this appointment, Ambassador Pascual served as the U.S. Ambassador to Mexico and was Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Studies Program here at the Brookings Institution. During his extensive career in public service, Ambassador Pascual has held positions also in the Department of State, the National Security Council, and the U.S. Agency for International Development. Ambassador Pascual received his MPP from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and it looks like we were there at the same time, Ambassador Pascual. He has served on the boards of directors for the National Endowment for Democracy, Freedom House, and the Internews Network. He has also served on the advisory group for the United Nations Peacebuilding Fund, and we're very happy to have him with us this morning. Our second discussant is George Ingram, who's senior fellow here at Brookings at the Global Economy and Development Program. During his long professional career, Greg Ingram has worked in Congress, the executive branch, and the nonprofit sector, all with a focus on international economic and development policy. He is also senior advisor currently for the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition and serves as co-chair of the Modernizing Foreign Assistance Network. Prior to his entry into Brookings as a scholar, Greg Ingram worked at AED, first as founding director of the Basic Education Coalition and subsequently in several other positions. He was principal deputy assistant administrator at USAID and vice president of Citizens Democracy Corps. And before that, early on in his career, he served as senior staff member of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, responsible for international economic and development issues. He serves on the boards of the Eurasia Foundation, the Executive Council on Diplomacy, and the Dockery Farm Foundation, and chairs the U.S. Advisory Council to Publish What You Fund. He has a PhD from the University of Michigan. So with that, may I invite Danny to come and make his presentation, 15 to 20 minutes, Danny.
Thank you, Tamar. Good morning to all of you. It's great to be back, back at Brookings, where I still feel so much at home, and I see so many friends, not only from Brookings, from elsewhere. So I really appreciate this opportunity, and I'm also humbled by the panelists that will come after me, so that makes me apologize in advance because I may go faster than usual through some of the slides because I want to hear from both Carlos and George. Let me start by suggesting that I'm making the presentation because there was the decision in our organization, but this is the collective effort of so many within Revenue Watch Institute and so many experts in the countries. You're talking about 100 people in total or more, and they are absolutely key people who were involved in authorship and in working on this report with me here today, including Juan Carlos Quiroz, Mary Linzer, so Alex Gillis, and Antoine Hoiti, to name a few. So this is a very significant project that took a very long time because it involved major data gathering and analysis for what we believe to be a very important issue. So in the minutes before me, I'm going to go quickly through some of the basics of the report. There's a lot more, not only in the a shorter printer version of the report that I hope everybody got, but now in the web with many more materials and the data and interactive functions and so on that we hope everybody will find very, very helpful. So I'll just mention in my remarks what's at stake, why this, what does the index measures, how the index is built, what are the results and main findings, and then on the recommendations, where I will be particularly brief because it's more in the report, but also because we are going to be much more enriched by the discussion and hearing Carlos and George on that. So in terms of what's at stake, just to put this issue in perspective, why it matters so enormously, we're talking about over 1 billion people that live in resource-rich countries and are basically below, making less than $5 a day, or 640 million living on $2 a day or less. And in fact, we get that by using Brookings numbers, including some researchers that help us with our project. Veronica Penchakova, who worked with me for many years, who is here. In 2011, also to put this in perspective, Nigeria's oil revenues alone, just that country, were 60% higher than the total aid, development aid, that went to all of sub-Saharan Africa. So we are talking about real money. This domestic resource issue is absolutely key. Aid can leverage, but let's put this in perspective. And also we are talking about an issue that matters not only from a narrow economic development standpoint, but also in terms of political aspects, democracy. Oil-rich states were three times less likely to democratize than non-oil producers, but also in terms of conflict, as we well know. So governance is the huge challenge before us in natural resources, but also for many of these countries, it matters so much, it's a solution. It's the development challenge of the decade for over 60 countries. And in this effort, in this analytical research, empirically based effort, we aim to help advance reforms in this sector. This is needed to raise awareness about a major development challenge in terms of having a measure on governance, accountability, and transparency in the sector, in terms of with real data and with analysis to try to concretize what may seem at first as a vague challenge, and lots of words are in print, but not necessarily very frequently with empirics and with data, and that having the data enables, we would hope that enables more empirical research and analysis by many scholars here, other think tanks, universities, and so on, and then that to be translated into evidence-based policy making. Evidence-based policy making is one of the mottos of Brookings and other think tanks that we know, but also evidence-based advocacy, which is taking hold increasingly, and that's what we all engage in. Informing dialogue across all stakeholders is very important too. This is a diagnostic tool also at the country level. We're going to go beyond, although I'll be very brief, just what are the rankings. It's an enormous amount of data for each country that is all available in the web. This resource governance index is, as mentioned, a measure of transparency and accountability in this oil, gas, and mining sector in 58 countries. And these many researchers gather primary information, filling up very rigorous questionnaires in 2012. That was vetted by peer reviewers, then fact-checked by the experts and the authors at Revenue Watch. The index, basically, the composite index, is comprised of four main components, three of which are very focused on the natural resource transparency and accountability issue. And the fourth is the broader governance-enabling environment at the country level. The first three, which are focused on natural resources, refer first about the norm setting. What kind of rules, regulations, legal norms, and institutions are in place or they are not in place, at least the jury in paper of these laws being adopted, Freedom of Information Act, and so on. The second then gets to actual disclosure, particularly regarding revenues that governments get from from companies. Is reporting, is disclosure taking place in natural resources, in oil, gas, and mining? And then the third is this data, is this information that is becoming available of good quality? Is it being checked? Does it have integrity? Are there checks and balances regarding that and quality controls regarding the whole disclosure issue? So these are basically the main components for the natural resource sector in particular. But of course, at the end of the day, even if there is progress in those particular areas, the full impact of more transparency and accountability would not be realized at the country level if there is no freedom of the press, there are no political civil liberties, the rule of law is not working, and there's enormous corruption at the country level. And that's why there's a fourth component, which is the broader governance framework, which does involve all these components. I want to get through this presentation sooner than later, so I'm not going to read this, but this is a way of saying, trust me, what we see in the screen are basically all the indicators for each one of these four components that inform the component. And we're talking about very, very concrete things in terms of the Freedom of Information Acts, in terms of the whether there's participation in an extractive industry transparency initiative or not, licensing processes, and on the checks and balances and on the reporting requirements, on whether state-owned companies are reporting or not, and in terms of the enabling environment, as we discussed, in terms of anti-corruption, rule of law, voice and democratic accountability, and government effectiveness. Let's go to some of the key results. So based on all this data, and then the aggregation to indicators, and then the aggregation of the indicators to the components, and then these components are aggregated into the composite, some key results and findings emerge. Allow me to provide some of the highlights. 11 countries out of the 58 countries which are surveyed do meet satisfactory standards of resource governance, at least. 47 do not, and many of them perform very poorly. In fact, they're very weak or even failing in terms of accountability and transparency in natural resources. We call this the governance deficit, which is very large for the vast majority, about 80% of the countries surveyed. And the governance deficit is the largest in the most resource-dependent countries, where many of the poor people live. That governance deficit also extends to state-owned companies and to the natural resource funds or sovereign wealth funds that these countries have. These major issues of opacity and lack of accountability with many of these funds and with state-owned companies. But the silver lining here is that there's variation. We have a number of countries we can see clearly that have satisfactory performance, and those perform satisfactorily in diverse contexts, including in emerging economies. We see here, in terms of the results, very briefly, there are four categories. Satisfactory are in the greener category, the 11 countries. Some of them are emerging economies, countries like Brazil, Mexico, Chile, and others perform satisfactorily. And then in the yellow, the partial satisfactory, some of them up there are in Africa, like Ghana and Liberia, for instance, that are making significant progress. But then the last two categories of rather weak performance or failing performance, the picture is very sobering. The challenge is enormous. Within those countries that perform very poorly, in fact, there are some very rich countries in terms of per capita income. There are some countries in the Gulf, like Qatar, that in terms of transparency on these areas are not doing well. So just being a rich country is no guarantee of performing well. And conversely, being an emerging economy or developing country is not a justification for not being able to do satisfactorily on this, as quite a few countries in Latin America and in Africa are showing. This is just a copy and paste from both the web and the report, to show the diversity in terms of the performance of countries, not only in terms of the composite index, which is the first column, but in terms of each one of the components. And some countries basically can be doing relatively well on some components, but not on others. So in that sense, it becomes also a diagnostic tool, and one can drill down to more of the data to figure out for each country where the strengths and where the weaknesses and the challenges are. And here we see what I just mentioned before, that transparency is missing where it is needed the most. Essentially, the more resource-dependent the country is, the less transparent it is. So this, that's a very important correlation. And that's across components, and for the composite, we see the diversity. This is a world map. If one goes to the web and clicks on the interactive environment on the world map, one can select the country by just mousing it over where one wants to get much more information. Just to come down from 30,000 feet and bring concrete illustrations of the governance deficit very quickly. In 20 countries, like in Venezuela, for instance, the substantial resource revenues just bypass totally the treasury and the overall budget. In 21 countries, including Guinea, which has been making lately some progress, but that's in 2013. Our measure is based on data collected in 2012, but in 21 countries do not publish information on primary sources of revenues, on royalties, profit shares, or taxes. In many countries, including Alberta, Canada, government officials do not disclose their financial interest in any extractive industry. And then a number of countries, including in the former Soviet world, have very poor records in the broader governance environment, including corruption, civil and political liberties, and democratic accountability. This graph is a bit cluttered, but let me explain very quickly. What it depicts is the differences in regional performance. This is on average for each region, and we need to be careful because it's variation within each region. But an important finding here is that the region that on average performs, is the most challenged, is the Middle East and North African countries. Africa has many challenges, but performs a bit better than the Middle East and North Africa on this. And for the Middle East countries, this is an incredibly important. We're talking about 80% of either their exports or revenues that go to the budget. So it's enormously important. There are also differences across components in terms of the challenges across the regions, which are important. Some are doing a little bit better on the enabling governance environment at the country level, but not so well on the natural resource transparency per se. Others, vice versa. Latin America as a region is doing better and getting closer, not there yet, to OECD standards. So it's important to also view this mixed picture, varied picture, and draw lessons from that. Specific areas of government shortcomings that come out from the report, as we said, we do go into the granularity and the details at the institutional level with all this data. So state-owned companies in 45 countries are also rated. And many of them, 18, are under no legal obligation to report information about their operations. Natural resource funds are also rated, as mentioned. 15 countries like Azerbaijan and Russia, spending from the funds bypasses legislative approval. This just shows the diverse performance of state-owned companies in 45 countries. For those who can see so many little columns, let me just comment that those that are very light, which happened to be performing better than the others, happened to be state-owned companies which have mixed ownership. So there is private ownership. So the mixed ownership, mixed-owned companies, on balance, tend to perform better than others, which is of interest. There is nothing predetermined that state-owned companies will always fail or perform poorly. Some are performing better. But if so, when they have all the checks and balances of having private capital and private partners, they perform better. Also, those that are listed in international market and subject themselves to the checks and balances of international capital perform better than those that do not. Natural resource funds, the sovereign wealth funds, there is an enormous challenge for a number of them, particularly, again, many in the Gulf, but also in other countries. We're talking about over $500 billion in the sovereign wealth funds of the very poorly performing countries, in particularly in the Gulf. This is out of a total of over $2 trillion, which are under management of all these sovereign wealth funds. So this is also part of the report. Let me start concluding now by recommendations to improve this. These are general recommendations that need to be adapted region by region, and that's also in the web, that there is more granularity, and then eventually country by country, and that's up to the country and their expert themselves to do so. So I'll just mention very briefly a few pointers more for the continuing of the discussion and debate. Disclosure of contracts is absolutely crucial. What kind of deals are companies and governors coming up with, and is there transparency at all stages regarding that? The answer right now is it's not, and that's why this is such a crucial issue and an issue where a global consensus has yet to emerge. We are at a much more incipient stage on this issue than on revenue transparency, where the train has departed in terms of the global movement towards having more transparency for revenue, but not so yet regarding transparency for contracts. So that's an absolutely crucial issue. Ensuring that regulatory agencies publish timely, comprehensive reports on oil, gas, and mining operations is key. It's key, and as it is, extending this transparency and accountability standard to state-owned corporations and to the natural resource funds. We just saw in the data why this is very much needed. A concerted effort then at the broader level in many of these countries is needed to control corruption, to strengthen the rule of law, and guarantee civil and political rights. And this doesn't just come from the data, obviously. The Arab Spring movement and many other such movements are basically increasingly demanding more accountability in that context. And then, last but not least, is the global mutual accountability and responsibility. Adopting international reporting standards for governments and companies, both context in international context of the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, already there is success. Dozens of countries have joined, but many have yet to join, including from the rich world, from the Middle East, and from Latin America. But also in terms of the extension, the globalization of mandatory reporting for companies as a listing requirement in exchanges throughout the world. That has started with the Dodd-Frank provision 1504, which was a game changer, even though it's still under litigation by the oil companies. But basically, the train has departed. The European Union is now agreeing to do the same. And next, it's very important to move into Canada, Australia, and many other markets. Let me just finish by just showing how much there is in the web. These are just pictures in terms of the different products. For each country, if one wants to drill down and look at all the data from the countries, including all indicators. Each one has a country page. So there are 58 printable pages, and there are also the detailed country questionnaires with the sources for every indicator score, fully there, full transparency. It is a diagnostic tool in that sense. There is an interactive tool for comparing and visualizing resource governance and for basically working with the data. And there are also these regional documents, regional fact sheets, because every region has its own challenges, realities, and also progress. Let me thank you.
Well, the panels are being mic'd. Let me say thank you to Danny for that fantastic presentation with lots of rich data and information on the resource-rich countries. I'd like to turn now to Carlos for his comments, about 7 to 10 minutes, if you would. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tamara, and to Brookings and to all of you for joining in this discussion. Let me just start by particularly giving thanks to Revenue Watch and Danny, the efforts that you've made to bring this analysis together, because by putting that data out there, you provide a mechanism, a tool for everybody in the community to be able to work more effectively. And you really provide a base to compare whether the efforts that we're making on the policy side, including efforts from EITI and 1504, to understand if they're making a difference. And I think that that is one of the critical things that we've had to really address. EITI has been in existence for a period of time. It's been a critical development. There are attempts to improve it. But here's the question that we have to keep coming back to, which is that over a period of time, there are countries that have adopted EITI requirements, but we still know that are challenged by corruption and performance, governance and transparency of their natural resources. And so what we have to understand from the outset is that the performance has not gotten to the place where we all would want it to be. And so the challenge that we're facing is how to keep driving it forward. And the only way to understand whether you're going to drive it forward is if you have a way to measure it. And so you've given us for the first time some systematic way to begin to do that. And I'm sure, as there has been in probably every transparency and governance index throughout the world, that you're going to get lots of complaints and comments and suggestions. But that's part of the transparency process, and what you have really done here is to put on the table the first measure that allows us to do this in a consistent way, and I congratulate you for that. It's extraordinarily important to do. The timing is really important. Throughout the world, one of the positive things that we have is that there is a lot more resource availability right now. And we're seeing throughout Africa, for example, in the Gulf of Guinea, the potential for new oil supplies in levels that we just hadn't anticipated before. Ongoing potential in Nigeria and Angola. If we go to the east part of Africa, gas supplies in Mozambique and Tanzania that have had some of the largest gas finds in the world in recent decades. There are traditional suppliers like Norway that are bringing more supplies onto the market. Russia has published that it will increase its gas supplies to the international market from about 670 billion cubic meters to about a trillion cubic meters by the year 2030. I just mention that in particular because it's just so huge. And so the importance of having a measure like this at this point in time, when countries such as Nigeria, Angola, or Ghana, or others in the Gulf of Guinea, or Mozambique, or Tanzania, or Myanmar, which is coming back onto the international scene, have the potential to develop their natural resources. It's a practical, important guide to help understand how those countries are doing. And not from a negative standpoint, but from an ability to work with them, because in the end, I think we have to work from the premise that these countries want to be able to use their resources to actually benefit their population and their country. And so how do we understand whether or not that's actually happened and use this in a constructive way? I think there's another perspective that we have to keep in mind on this, which is energy access to electricity within individual countries in the developing world. It's not the direct issue that is addressed in the index. But here's the basic reality. There are 1.3 billion people in the world that don't have access to electricity. In Africa, it's about 600 million. There's probably another 400 million in India, and Indonesia probably makes up another biggest block. China still has significant portions of its population without access to electricity. And just from a practical political perspective, at a certain point, it's hard to imagine that the world will be able to continue to work on the extraction of resources to satisfy international markets if domestic populations are not getting access to electricity. And we have a stake in that. We have a fundamental stake in it, because in any economic analysis that's been done on the correlation between economic development or economic growth and anything else, access to energy consistently comes in as, if not the strongest, one of these strongest factors. And so there's a practical dimension here from a development standpoint. There's a practical political issue. And then there's the practical development standpoint that for those countries, the resources they get from natural resource extraction are obviously critical to their ability to actually continue to develop. But this isn't just, I think, as you said, an issue for developing countries or poor countries. It's an issue for all countries. And that's why the Obama administration has made a decision for the United States to join the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. And I know we've got some colleagues here from the Department of Interior who are managing this process here in the United States. And, you know, it's a mess, right? in a good way, because when you start thinking through all of the states that you have to work with, all of the non-governmental groups that have an interest and are involved, the diversity of their laws and regulations, the federal aspects of this, and you put that together, and you're committed to the point of saying everybody's got to be consulted and brought into the process, one might say, you know, wow, that's a lot of trouble. But the reality is that we've come to the conclusion of saying that we owe the population of our country the ability to have a voice and to have that accountability. And so understanding that and knowing that it's important for us here in the United States is indicative, I think, of approaching an index like this and the work that we're trying to do to be able to expand this throughout the world. A couple of things that I just wanted to say about the index and its complementary nature to EITI and things like Dodd-Frank and Section 1504. Because in the end, the index helps us really understand whether the measures that we're changing and improving are really actually having an impact. It gives us a way to be able to assess the judge and adjust over this period of time. And let me just mention a couple of the things that we're all struggling with in terms of being able to address in a more effective way. One is an understanding of the resource base itself. In many countries, there isn't an understanding of what the level of resources might be. And that creates huge expectations in populations of vast resources and wealth that are going to be coming in. And being able to manage those expectations, manage those resources, manage how you handle tender rounds and how you gauge that and handle it over time is a huge challenge. There's a question of resource valuation and monetization, and here in particular, gas is especially important because the global gas market is changing radically. It was once dominated by pipelines between one country and another country, and you had a virtual monopoly between the supplier and consumer, and now increasingly gas is traded as LNG. You get a massive variation in prices around the world depending on where your supplies are and what you're able to trade. And so how you understand that resource and how you play into that global market is going to be a critical factor. A third issue concerns contracts and tenders. You mentioned the issue of reporting of contracts. It still hasn't been agreed upon generally throughout the international community. But one of the things that we know is that the way that you handle a contracting process and a tender process is going to be key to the credibility of whether or not those contracts can maintain, let's say, can be perceived as being awarded in a way which is fair and based on the actual offers that are being made. There are issues related to revenue, obviously, that have consistently been on the table on the part of the international community, reporting the revenues that are coming in. But the expenditure side of the equation is still a challenge. On the new rules on EITI, you'll have to report what goes from a revenue account to what goes into the budget, what goes to a subnational level if that is a mandatory requirement, or if there's a transfer to an off-budget account. These are going to be critical requirements to maintain over time, but doing it and handling it is going to be really hard because we all know and have seen situations where if money goes into the budget, how to be able to track it further on down the line as contracts are let and there are other procurement activities is going to be a challenge. I wanted to mention the environmental and resource management side for a minute because it doesn't usually get enough attention. But there's a challenge in countries to be able to extract resources, develop them to achieve revenues, and how that is balanced with the protection of the resource itself, protection of reservoirs or protection of a natural resource environment around the actual development of the natural resource of the extractive industry is going to be absolutely critical. And what kind of rules and regulations are put in place to do that and under what kind of time frame are these things done? And so two final things that I would say. One is the importance of civil society and engagement in these processes. And the reason I raise that is because in the end, people who are in governance and in government and who are in politicians in countries that have large volumes of natural resources have a political incentive to be able to control those resources. This is power, right? But what do you do to be able to give them an incentive to create greater transparency on how those resources are managed? And if civil society, if the population who votes doesn't have the ability to weigh in and have an impact on the viability and longevity of that government, then you have a misbalanced equation. All right, so the state of Alaska, for example, the mechanism that is achieved there is that there's a transfer. Every person in Alaska, they know that they're going to get revenues back from Alaska's natural resources. They have an interest and incentive of being able to trying to make sure that there's transparency in the way that those funds are managed. Is it a panacea? Maybe not, because there are real challenges in how Alaska manages its budget, because so much is actually locked into a special account for the management of those resources. But it illustrates the point that there is a stake that every single citizen in that state has in the management of those resources. How do we learn from that and extend that more broadly? And finally, the other point, Danny, that you've put into the index is how do you translate this into laws and institutions? Because in the end, you can't just do this on an ad hoc basis. The United States, the State Department, has had a program here with a couple of my colleagues, Bob Sakuta, my principal deputy, Marty Flax, who have been responsible for both managing the U.S. participation in EITI as well as a program called the Energy Governance and Capacity Building Initiative. And so what we've been trying to do is to work with countries. I see some others that are in the back, too. Good to see you. We've been trying to work with countries that have emerging natural resource wealth and helping them develop the capabilities to be able to manage their resources, to manage the policies around them, to help build their institutions. And the funds that we have are small, but it can be a catalyst to have an impact and try to achieve policy change in individual countries and address some very specific problems. And I think that what you've put on the table is a mechanism to keep on encouraging us to keep working through institutions like EITI, to work through 1504 and the importance of dealing with payments that are made to governments, to work with specific technical assistance programs, and then keep asking the question, are we making a difference? Because if we make that difference, then everybody benefits. The countries themselves benefit, the citizens of those countries benefit because they get access to greater resources. We get the greater possibility of having a more consistent inflow of resources into the international community. And we have the benefit of ensuring that we can approach the governance of the sector in a way that avoids corruption and is true to the effective and appropriate management of the natural resource base that we want to preserve. So thank you for what you've done, and thank you for sparking and stimulating the conversation.
Thank you very much, Carlos. A little over the allotted time, but I think you'll agree, well worth it. So I heard a great deal of endorsement of this effort, in particular because it provides an opportunity for many stakeholders interested in this area to know whether or not changes, reforms that are being spearheaded are making a difference. And having this tool allows us to be able to do that. And you also pointed to a number of areas that are outside the index. Expenditure side, as well as how countries do on environmental and resource protection. So perhaps we can come back to that in the discussion as being part of the next steps on where this initiative might go forward. George, may I turn to you
Thank
now?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let me join Carlos in congratulating you. As someone who believes strongly in transparency, this index makes a great contribution, both in being very useful and being very timely. It's useful in that it highlights the shadowness in the natural resource extraction industry, the opaqueness of both government and industry, and the vast resources that are lost to country economic development. But it also highlights the potential for better behavior as you look at some of the poorer countries who are actually setting good examples. It's timely in a couple of ways. There's a companion study being released by the Africa Progress Panel, chaired by Kofi Annan, on equity and extractives. And the lead author of that is another Brookings scholar, Kevin Watkins. And both the report and Kofi Annan personally are taking up the charge of advocating for corporate transparency and tax compliance in this area. Secondly, as most people know, Prime Minister Cameron intends on using the G8 meeting next month to focus on these issues and to discuss trade, tax, and transparency, specifically as it affects the extractive industries. My comments are going to focus on a couple of discouraging facts, a few encouraging developments, and a couple of recommendations. And what is clear to me from the index, and it's a little different from your interpretation, is that this is very much an Africa problem. If you look at those 11 countries that are in the satisfactory category, they're all OECD and Latin America. If you look at the next category of partially compliant, of those 15 countries, only three are from Southern Africa. And if you look at the last two categories of weak and failing, almost half of those countries or in Southern Africa. And what is it that the core of the problem is? According to an IMF study, of the 20 resource-rich countries in Southern Africa, and they represent 56% of the population and 80% of the income of Africa, nine are among the 12 lowest holders on the Human Resource Index. And 14 of those have human resource index standards lower than their income rank. They are headlined by Equatorial Guinea, one of the fastest growing economies, which has an HDI rank, which is 91 positions below its income rank. Angola, which since 2002 has had economic growth of 7% or more a year, which generates government revenues between $3 and $6 billion, has the eighth highest child mortality rate in the world. But on the positive side, you have Sierra Leone, which has now put online data for its mining contracts and government revenues. Ghana has established transparency standards that exceeds those of the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative and has put its oil agreements online. Liberia is publishing contracts for mining oil and forestry and has signed on to the Extractive Initiative. Now, despite this, there have been recent reports of noncompliance in Liberia, including a report by the government watchdog that found only 2 of 68 resource contracts that were conducted properly. Now, the question for Carlos and Danny is, do we see this as a failure, or do we see this as a success of transparency in a country that's trying to lay out its dirty linen and trying to get improvement? What can we do in this area? The report focuses on what governments in natural extracting countries can do, and it lays out a good agenda that needs to be supported. I want to focus in other areas. If you look at foreign assistance, I initially think foreign assistance could be a good lever on bringing country into greater compliance. Foreign assistance is the largest source of external financing for 20 of the 28 lowest income African countries. But of the 46 countries that are below the satisfactory level on Danny's index, only 6 of those countries have an external assistance level greater than 5% of GNP, and only 3 of those are above 15%. And one of them is Liberia, which ranks 16, which is a pretty good performer, and the other two are Afghanistan and Congo, which I wouldn't hold out a lot of hope of using our aid as leverage. Add to that the decades of failure of using foreign assistance for policy conditionality, and I think this is a dead end. But there is a positive end of how you can use foreign assistance, and that is enhancing the performance of government capability. There are a number of areas in which foreign assistance can be used to build up the capacity of a government to be able to better manage its natural resource endowments. One is taxation. We're beginning to see a movement in the foreign assistance in the donor community of acknowledging that we need to help governments develop their own capacity to develop their own revenues. This would be a logical area in the area of tax regimes and adherence where the donors could step up their contribution. Other areas are improving public financial management, data collection and analysis, which is critical to understanding what's going on, creating regulatory regimes, and establishing transparent government policies and implementations. I was going to talk about Western compliance with the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, but Carlos has really handled that, and in some conversations I had the last couple of days, I find that the U.S. government is moving ahead in a very brisk pace in coming into compliance. And I guess our role there is to encourage other Western countries who haven't signed up to the initiative to do so. At the multilateral level, given the widespread secrecy of corporate ownership and the fact that some 60% of global trade is intra-corporate, I think the G8 and the G20 need to listen to David Cameron and begin to talk about establishing common rules on beneficial ownership, taxation, and transfer pricing. I also was going to talk a little bit about the role of the private sector and the Extractive Industries Initiative, and I'll just restrict that to say that when I started my professional career, the multinational corporation was sort of treated either with disdain as a source of economic imperialism, particularly in the mining area, or was ignored as a development actor. Today, we're in a much different climate, and people in the development community are beginning to acknowledge that the corporate community has a critical role to play in promoting development, some actually, some potentially. And I would just note that some 70 corporations have signed up to the Extractive Industries Initiative, and 80 financial institutions. And I think expanding that is one way to box poor performing developing governments into being more into improving their own practices. Finally, Danny, it's seldom that I read a report and my attention gets caught by the first paragraph on the first page. But that number you have in there, that in 2010, of your 58 countries, they generated $2.6 trillion in profits, and maybe a lot of those profits were rents. It's just an inconceivable number to me. And if you add that, the results of the Global Financial Integrity, which calculates that Africa loses in a year $38 billion in transfer pricing and another $25 billion in illicit outflows, you begin to think about what could be accomplished if you could capture 10% or 5% or 1% of that wealth and devote it to education and health and social safety nets. And that makes you to begin to realize that this conversation in the post-2015 agenda and discussions of getting to zero poverty, of eliminating poverty by 2030, is not a pipe dream. The resources are there, the wealth are there. It's really an issue of political will and adopting the right policies, both by business and by government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George, and also for exercising self-restraint and not repeating points that have been made.
I conceded a few minutes to Carlos.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank you for bringing up the questions around how these countries perform on human development indicators. This is an area close to my heart, having been Vice President for Human Development at the World Bank in my last position, an area on which I'd like to work with Danny, and now I realize I have a kindred spirit in you as well, and that's wonderful. So let me, in the next section of this discussion, what I'd like to do is ask three questions. I think they're primarily to Danny, but I expect our other two panelists will have views on this as well. And then at the end of that, I'll turn it over to the audience for questions and comments. So, Danny, first question. You've done a lot of work in overall governance. And so my first question is what you see as the interplay between the governance indicator that has been developed here, which focuses on the resource sector, and overall governance indicators for a country. So it was interesting for me to see that you have a number of countries that do well on the overall governance, but do poorly in governance in the resource sectors. And you have the inverse as well, countries that do poorly on the overall enabling environment, but do well on resource governance. So do you see this as, I guess the example I was thinking about is like special economic zones. You have a certain privileged regimes taking advantage of, in particular, foreign investors to come up with the model that then somehow spreads to the rest of the economy. Is that the way to think about it? And have we seen any examples where that kind of spillover, positive spillover, has taken place?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And I think it's context specific. Okay, we have countries like Iraq, Azerbaijan, and quite a few others that they are making inroads in adopting the legal institutions and rules to strive to transparency and to accountability in the very focused natural resource area. But they have serious challenges with a broader nationwide governance environment, in terms of rule of law, civil society engagement, all these issues that were mentioned. In many contexts, the expectation would be that could lead to a dynamic where that spreads. But let's be mindful that the political obstacles sometimes for improving rule of law and for anti-corruption more broadly are beyond one particular sector. So we need to to basically keep in mind that parallel efforts would have to be mounted, and including the type of suggestions that you and Carlos gave, and it will not happen just naturally and organically because it has started in the natural resource sector. Because the main point that emerges from your question is the following. At the end of the day, if the country does adopt in the regulations, in paper, many of the good measures and freedom of information laws and so on, but the overall enabling environment is not there, as Carlos said, for accountability to really take hold, the fruits of that transparency in natural resources are going to be much more limited than if there is an interaction with a broader governance environment which is evolving, which is reforming and functioning. You have the opposite, which is the cases like Botswana, where they have done quite well in terms of their broader governance framework and rule of law and so on. And these, we would expect that this would be a wake-up call, a call for action. Look, you have done well, and they're very proud about it. In terms of governance indicators, they put it in the presidential website. But on natural resources, it's enormous to do. But they have shown that it can be done in these broader issues. So there we would expect a spillover effect in the other direction. Having said that, just one a wonky statistical point. There are some countries where there are these gaps between how they're performing natural resources and in the environment. But the overall correlation is still about 0.6, particularly with the actual reporting requirements. And there are also some interesting disconnects that one could have mentioned within the natural sector. So a country can have the legal norms. The Azerbaijans of this world, and many other countries, they are beginning to go through the motions, thanks to EITI and so on, and this is very important, and adopting some laws. That doesn't mean that in practice there is quality reporting at every level or that contracts are being fully reported. So your point also applies within the natural resource sector in various components.
Thanks. Carlos or George, any
The only thing I would add is I have a strong belief in the power of incentives and in the power of information. And I believe, one, the information that you're producing needs to be distributed. You need an advocacy side of what you're doing. And two, if you could get almost all of the companies to sign up to making transparent their payments, that is eventually going to seep in to the politics of a country. And that you might even see the resource extracting industry with that information coming out of the private sector, the international private sector, as a way to force change, as a way to galvanize citizen action within a country, to galvanize change.
One of the things I would just add is that, you know, if we think back into the 1990s when governance and rule of law issues first started to get onto the development agenda, there's a huge debate about what that meant. And you too will remember at the World Bank that, you know, before Wolfensohn and a lot of work that you did with him at the beginning, and he brought that and made that a mainstream issue on the development agenda, development institutions didn't touch this. And so one of the things that we have to continue to work on is a broader integration around governance issues, those questions which involve natural resources and extractive industries. And it's emerging. It's still proceeding. I think one of the things we have to recognize is that in some cases there are countries that have had reasonable governance records and have new findings on natural resources, and building up the skills and the capabilities to manage that is something that has to catch up, and there are circumstances that we find that. The other thing that I think just stands out is that there are countries that have extensive extractive industry potential but have just come out of conflict. And that creates a whole series of other challenges that you might be able to improve some measures quickly by putting in place an institutional framework or a legal framework, better said, but following up with the institutions and the civil society aspects that are necessary to make that work are just a lot harder to do. And that's one of the practical realities of why we've got to break this down to individual cases and understand what the problems are in those circumstances.
Second question. I think actually George's response provides a nice segue to this. You talked about the power of information and incentives. The question I had, Danny, is the index is essentially an instrument for looking at how countries perform on transparency and accountability in this sector and putting that information out in the public domain. So I wanted to ask you explicitly about, since I think everyone on the panel agrees, ultimately we're interested in the utilization of these resources effectively for development purposes, to improve the well-being of the population of those countries. So what is explicitly sort of the theory of change? What do you expect will happen with this information, this resource governance index being out there? How do you expect that to lead to those changes that will make a difference in people's lives? What needs to happen? What are the sort of causal links in this chain that would lead to that overall improvement? Because I can think of many instances where I'd say information is important and necessary, but certainly not sufficient. How do you act on that information? What does it take?
I hope you don't expect to have the exact answer, because especially when it comes to data analytical and research products, sometimes there's a law of unintended consequences, and I think there's a role of providing these for researchers, for advocates, and then things happen. Having said that, here some principles, which I think the eloquent remarks by Carlos and George made it in terms of what is behind this, what is the rationale, the $2.6 trillion, let's start with that, the potential for the major transformative power of these resources, these natural resource riches that have not been translated into human capital and human resources, as you have said. This is the development challenge of the decade, as we said. Many countries, many governments, many state-owned corporations, and many global multinational corporations are not doing well. That has been established. So if we put all these tenets together, then if we strongly believe, and the evidence from so many other research, including what we have done more broadly about governance, shows that sunshine is the best disinfectant, we are back to the issues of transparency and also accountability with that transparency. If we believe in that, and at the same time we believe, like we in Revenue Watch, and let me please ask, it's not my index, it's our our index. I take the heat of any problem and any error, but
well,
this
we're
is a
give
collective
you the heat,
effort.
We get to give you the praise, too.
No, but it's collective from our whole organization and other partners. But we believe very strongly in the power of data, the power of evidence-based analysis, every evidence-based also advocacy. Nowadays, modern advocacy, and it was shown with the Dodd-Frank, how the advocacy movement use information and data to really affect a major change in legislation, rather than the old-style advocacy, which was not empirically evidence-based. So we get then to the issue of how important it is to codify this, however painstakingly this has to be done, and it was very difficult work done by my colleagues for years with the experts throughout these 58 countries. Let me just add to this that in this effort, not only the experts in these questionnaires and the work on the narrow on the focus issues of natural resource transparency are there, but also these external indicators on the overall governance framework. Here in the audience is Warren Krafcik, who heads the International Budget Project. We use also that very important effort for our effort in terms of transparency in the whole budgetary effort. So we try to go downstream in that type of context, because that transparency in the budget overall is absolutely crucial for resource-dependent countries in terms of effective use.
Either of you want to add to that?
You know, I guess I have a very simple theory of change when it comes to policymaking, and that is it takes three things to move policymakers. And the first thing you have to do is you have to appeal to their heart. And we saw this in the education area in foreign aid 15 years ago when policymakers in this country and the Congress and the executive branch responded to the press reports of girls in Afghanistan not being allowed to go to school. That just instinctively appealed to policymakers across the board. And then when you gave them the facts that 80 million children around the world weren't in school, they began to realize that this was a global problem. And then you have to give them a solution. And I think there are plenty of heartstring stories around the world on the impact of poverty. Danny's index are showing you, I apologize.
Our index.
The resource index shows that the poor governance of natural resource is both widely spread in many countries and is hiding a lot of wealth, is preventing a lot of wealth and resources from getting into productive activities. And then you need to offer them a solution. And the report offers some solution, and we've offered some others. So I think you've got the components there of change.
I would just add a couple of things. One, you know, if you think about the different actors and stakeholders in this process, right? So first of all, you've got governments themselves. And as governments know that their performance is being measured, that creates an incentive on how they perform, how they're seen, and trying to make that explicit, I think, is absolutely key. For civic groups within countries, it gives them a basis to then understand what's happening internally within their country, but understand it relative to others, so that they can point to those cases where it's not just a question of being part of a particular geography, but it's relative to the way that policies are actually implemented, and I think that that can help. I think it helps to the extent to which countries want to take advantage of it, civic groups want to take advantage of it, of making these political issues that influence the way populations vote and influence pressure on their governments. For private companies, I think it's a key factor that they have to take into consideration if they're operating in countries with consistently low levels of performance. How do they respond to that, and how do they deal with it? And what kind of discussions take place in their board meetings about their investment policies in those countries and how they handle those particular challenges. And finally, I think the other part that I think we have to give increasingly more attention to is to state-owned companies that are operating in countries with, particularly developing and emerging countries with resource-rich capabilities, where there has been a legacy, let's say, of unusual mechanisms in which contracts are made, where the ability to promise a road or promise a particular school building becomes a factor in the way that a contract is let and the nature of those contracts, which may not necessarily bring the best benefit to that country if, in fact, it's not done in a way that results in the best payments to those individual governments. So those are, I think, various areas where this can have an impact. And it's going to take the index itself isn't going to make the change. It's going to provide the tool out there for all of you and many others to then take that and to keep driving it forward. But what we haven't had in the past is some consistent mechanism to be able to grab something and say, look, at least here is one transparent indicator of performance and use that as a way to drive action and accountability. And that I think is where the key contribution is.
Great. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to exercise self-restraint and not ask my third question and open it up to all of you. Okay. Do we have a mic that's circulating? Okay. Let's start on this side. Yeah, with the lady. If you would just briefly state who you are.
Hi, I'm Laurie Sherman with the U.S. chapter of Transparency International and an alternate member of the EITI U.S. I find the list of EITI members that are failing and weak really discouraging. And I'm wondering if you have, besides your recommendations, other suggestions on how we can make EITI more useful. I mean, you look at this and you say these countries have been at it for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and it really is very discouraging.
Thank you. Let's take a few. And it'd be great if you could be equally brief in your comments so we can take more. Yes, the lady in the back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Moran from the National Democratic Institute, and I work on the governance team. I was struck by the fact that it seems as though the institutional and legal framework drags up everyone's scores, especially even in the failing countries. So in terms of the next steps, if it's not advising governments on creating legal frameworks that are good governance, that have good governance components, what's the next best intervention on the governmental side? I know you spoke about civil society, but in terms of working with governments, what recommendations do you have?
Okay. There's a gentleman in the back there. Yeah.
Yes, hi. My name is Steve Woodward. I work for the West Africa Oil Watch. What we do is we monitor corporate activity in the sub-Saharan region pertaining to basically contract analysis and its effect on civil society. I thought there was an amazing point made upon the idea of analyzing policy.
Can you hold the microphone closer?
Yeah.
Sorry. Analyzing policy rather than geography. As we may know, Togo and Benin, they're almost declared as one country because of the discourse, the trade of oil between those two countries. It becomes very blurry in terms of tracking what's going on within those regions. Right now, we actually have a journalist program in Sierra Leone, and I would like to say that we've been following Revenue Watch for quite a while. It's been absolutely incredible information obtained. What I would like to know is that what exactly would you need to further that research, that data analysis? What would you suggest that we could focus on? We're a regional society within that area. We operate directly in that area to unify communities. And we use, again, Peter Eigen's and Open Oil's How to Read and Understand an Oil Contract to educate regional populations on how to understand these issues. What would you recommend that we focus on to better help progress this research and progress this data analysis? Thank you.
I'll take one more here.
Yes, I'm Bill Kudlowski, Petropolitan. Sorry, my tongue is a bit stuck right now. I wish this was called the Index of Misgovernance instead of Governance, because in my country, over 97% of all the exports of the whole nation goes directly to the government. You can't have government under such circumstances. Whatever you sell, an index of governance, you're selling the false illusion to people that there is a way to overcome such a dramatic disbalance of power. Over 97% of all the nation exports goes directly into government coffers. Don't create false expectations there.
Okay. Can I have a show of hands as to how many others have questions? Okay, so we'll do one more round after this, if you don't mind. So there were four questions. Any suggestions on improving EITI's contributions, given the results from this index? Beyond putting in place legal frameworks, what more can governments do? Maybe I'll expand the question from the gentleman from the Africa Transparency Oil and Gas Group, saying, what next? What would you want researchers to do, civil society to do, governments to do as a follow-up to this index? And a provocative question about the fundamental imbalance in power. So maybe I'll turn that around and say, do you see a role for that might mitigate that imbalance of power, more Alaska-like sort of direct cash transfers to the population as a way of addressing that? So let's start with Carlos and go down the line and end up with Danny.
I'll comment on a few of the things. First of all, the question about EITI is a very good one, and I have to commend EITI because one of the things that they have spent the majority amount of time on the board actually discussing is exactly this question of if you have this correlation between EITI members and countries that are not performing well, what to do about it. Bob Skuda, my deputy, who is the U.S. representative on the EITI board, will be going to Australia next week, participating in the board meeting. One of the things that they have been debating and discussing are what are some of the measures that need to be put in place in order to address exactly the kind of issue that you're putting on the table. I think one of the things that has come out of that discussion is the importance of dealing with the expenditure side of the equation, because in the past, EITI has had a requirement that you had to have a centralized account for the deposit of revenues. But beyond that, there hasn't been clarity on how expenditures are necessarily being managed. And I think that that's going to be an important addition. There's still going to be huge gaps. There's a debate, exactly as Danny said, about how to handle the contract issues. And here there are legitimate questions that are being debated between those who are in governments, those who are in civil society, and those who are in the private sector about how to manage this, where you get into the disclosure of proprietary information, how to achieve the right balance. We don't have a solution on that yet. And I think that one of the things that we're going to see out of this process is that there will be improved measures that are adopted by the EITI board in a short period of time. But the other piece of it is that it's not going to be over. There are going to be a whole series of things that will have to continue to be addressed where we're going to have greater improvements in performance. In terms of following up and movement into the future, I think that one of the biggest questions that we still have a gap on is the point that I mentioned earlier on the political equation, where if you think about the resource levels that are coming back into governments and the traditional forms of centralized governance and control over resources where resources have meant power, the incentives for politicians to give that up are really low. And so you have to create a different political incentive structure. And so how do you change that equation? And changing that equation is fundamentally going to have to involve strengthening the role of civil society and strengthening the political processes in which pressures that are brought on politicians help them equate with their ability to stay in government is somehow associated with the way that they govern the resource base and ensure that it is broadly distributed rather than simply centralized. That is a huge, huge challenge. And we are really at a beginning point right now, I think, in trying to understand what are the best models, what are the best forms of technical support to civic institutions, and what kind of dialogue needs to take place with political leaders. But at least we're starting to have that discussion, and I think it's something that we have to keep maintaining on the agenda. And I think having the index, having this kind of discussion that you're stimulating at Brookings is part of what we need to continue to achieve some momentum in that direction.
Thank you. George?
Yeah. On those countries that have signed up to the extractive initiative, and Carlos can respond to this better than I can. I noticed on the website when I looked at it over the weekend that there were probably 6 or 7 or 8 countries whose compliance had been suspended. So there does seem to be some accountability. I don't know if there are any repercussions from that accountability, but at least there seems to be some accountability built in there. And, I've been involved in development for 35 years. And I think when I look back where the world started, where the world was, it fuels my optimism. And development and change takes a long time. Just to combine this answer to the legal framework question, USAID was heavily involved in the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, as Carlos knows well, in the 90s, in introducing regulation, in introducing commercial law and regulatory bodies, central banks, regulatory bodies to regulate stock markets, etc. The results today, 20 years later, mixed results. Some of those regulatory efforts in countries where you had strong political will are doing very well. In other countries where you didn't have strong political will, some of them have fizzled. I think that AID, I'm sure the World Bank, has a long history of helping governments build up their capacity to manage markets and to manage commercial activities where they have to be regulated. And I think that's an important area where the donor community can make a contribution in this area.
Danny.
EITI, let's not despair too early. I mean, first of all, it's a few years old. It takes time for institutional change to take hold. It has had, I think, a very, very important start. As Carlos just said, it's at a crucial crossroad now. If these major reforms within EITI, which would expand the scope of what's required, they take hold, which is expected, that could be a game changer, because there was an increasing realization that the earlier mandate was just too narrow on certain legal and rules issues vis-a-vis transparency for payments without getting into the details. Getting into the details of the revenues, getting into contracts is absolutely crucial. Getting into disclosure by state-owned corporations is part of the next stage. Issues on beneficiary ownership. Who are the owners of this company? So transparent in that. That's part of the new agenda, which hopefully will be adopted and implemented soon. That's absolutely critical. That relates to the other question that some of these countries are showing better performance on one particular component, which is the rules. The laws have been adopted and so on, but not on the rest. That's part of the issue. When these international initiatives start and they can be very narrow and legalistic at first, then countries know how to play the game and then can tick the boxes. But then implementation has to take place, and it has to be broadened, and that's part of the EITR reforms now. But also as important is to be very mindful what cannot be expected from EITI to deliver the ultimate goods. Each one of these initiatives has its mandate, and it has to be focused, but then it has to complement and collaborate much more in the future with other initiatives. And that's where the expenditure side issues come, and that's why there are other initiatives, but also anti-corruption, and that's why Transparency International and others come into play. So at the end of the day, if it's just narrow transparency issues on natural resources, and it stays like was at the beginning of EITI, we call it a narrow, lonely, and zombie transparency. It will not deliver the goods if it's not complemented with rule of law and anti-corruption. It will be transparency without sanction and with total impunity. It will not happen. So it's absolutely crucial to complement it with the rest. And that's where also our... Hopefully, our tool comes in. And as mentioned here, it's just it's a tool, but it's a very important tool. Increasingly, we're engaging not only with civil society, which is crucial, but with civil society and governments working in the countries and helping those reformers who are asking the question, how do we go about in a rigorous way of identifying what needs to be done next, which relates very quickly to your question about next stage. I mean, we can have a much longer conversation about what other research and work is needed. But one is at the country level to follow the money, and that's a completely different type of skills and researchers. Meeting with Raj Shah, the administrator of USAID, a couple of days ago, he was asking, can this great tool that you have tell us how much of the mineral resources within the DRC are going to the militia? The answer is, frankly, no, that can't. But that's why the in-country initiatives are crucial, as well as working with the local experts, reformers, researchers, civil society leaders, and also government reformers. There are many government reformers who are engaging with us and with others, using these types of tools, hopefully in the future, and complementary tools to advance the analysis and then the policy.
Okay, I need some guidance here. This is my first Brookings seminar, so I don't know if it's okay to go over the time limit. We do it all the time at the bank, but don't know Brookings practice here.
Thank you. Or just signal. Don't
we have to wrap up?
Don't go too long.
Okay, we have to wrap up. Can I take one more?
Two.
You should take two more, and then we can.
Okay, I'll take two more. Okay, I'll take the gentleman there, and you.
Thank you very much. My name is Suruma. I'm from Uganda. I used to be a fellow here some years back. I think that we welcome this kind of work because we are desperate for a tool that we can use to put pressure on the government domestically. But I think the tool has to be simple enough for us to understand. And it has to be clear that the tool is not suspect, that it's not something being imposed from outside. So there's a need for transparency, for understanding the tool itself as a truly moral instrument that we can use from a domestic point of view, civil society and so on, and also from the outside, if there can be some agreement internationally, from the outside and from inside, so that we can bring pressure on the governments to do what is right. So it's important that we understand it, that it has some sort of moral convergence or agreement, because I think some of the things that come from the West are suspect, that they are tools of imperialism and so on. So the extent that we can agree on the tool itself as something that is transparent, I think can help us to do a better job. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Edwards. I'm, I guess, retired. I was for 15 years president of the Ethics Resource Center here in Washington. Did a lot of consulting with multinational corporations, 150 or so of them, all of them in trouble. And then I retired to raise two little girls for 8 years, and now I'm back. Not at the Ethics Resource Center, but as a loose cannon, interested in international corruption and looking at it from both sides, private sector and public. Statistics and indices and measures, such as have been explained today, are very valuable as opposed to just anecdotes. Anecdotes sometimes get
Let's
in the way.
Let's get to the question if
I'm
we can.
I'm getting right to
Thank
the question. The World Bank has done such a great job since Wolf and Son of focusing on corruption, anti-corruption. South Africa has, over the years, adopted virtually every model statute that's been out there. And yet in 2010, the World Bank approved a $10 billion investment in, I think it was ESCOM, at a time when it was public knowledge in the South African newspapers that government officials did not disclose, as the law required, their private investments, and many of them were investors in ESCOM.
I'm listening for the question.
The question is, what do you make of the World Bank's decision to make such a major investment at a time when the law was being violated? And second, how does the index account for assessing South Africa under such circumstances?
Okay, I'm just going to give the last word
Maybe
to...
Maybe that last question goes to... I said major shareholder.
I was here at Brookings.
So, a good question on ownership by the countries themselves
right.
of the index. And I want to generalize the last question about the last question to the role of foreign assistance in spurring reforms, which is a point that George made. So. Let's get away from South Africa, but talk about what role there is for foreign assistance to affect change.
First, I totally agree. The issue of ownership is absolutely crucial. And for full disclosure, I am from an emerging economy, from Chile, so I'm a passionate believer on that. In fact, right as we speak, simultaneously, this is being discussed with key leaders and civil society in the releases of that in a number of countries, in Accra for Africa, in in Indonesia, and in other places. Second, the 100 or so people involved, these expert researchers who filled every questionnaire are local experts. And third, the most important objective, if you ask me, of this work in the next stage, at a very practical level, is to work in the country with those experts, with the reformists in government, civil society leaders who are engaged and want to do reform and use the country-specific data and not get into just a competitive little ranking of this or that. So I encourage everybody to go to the website, because talking about transparency, which are a big believer, we put everything there with what we hope are going to be very useful tools to do exactly that. Role of foreign assistance, in terms of the particular question of one huge project, in fact, we have been invited, among other places, to discuss this tool and this report at the World Bank, so we'll be sure to raise that very specific issue, and which may be part of the discussion that will be later in the month. But more generally, I for the sake also of time, I defer to your excellent points on foreign aid. On the one hand, let's keep in mind that we are talking here in terms of the natural resource challenge about a much larger issue than foreign aid in terms of domestic resource mobilization. That's why we stress it, where foreign aid, more than the money, I mean, the money is important for some countries. It's very important, the poorest of the poor and those and fragile states and so on. But for the others, the focus should be on the technical assistance, on the know-how transfer, which is where we are also involved and we are collaborating with the World Bank, rather than thinking that one particular loan from the World Bank or other in this day and age is what's going to make the difference. It's more the catalytic effect of working together in terms of empowering the reformists of the country to affect change that we believe in. And that's why this tool, I think, is very important.
Great. Well, I want to close this seminar by congratulating the Revenue Watch Institute for having put out this really important tool for many of you in this room and outside, and in particular in countries themselves, to use really as a tool for demanding greater transparency and accountability in the resource sector and beyond, to the benefit of the people of those countries. And I'd like to thank our excellent panelists, and I hope you'll give them a hand.